IIT Bombay, and this year 2010 I'm spending on a sabbatical at McGill and also at Université de Montréal. And a student of mine, Brajesh Kumar from IIT Bombay, could also spend 6 months in UDM. So we have a work done together with Manu here, who will hopefully not point out the things I make mistakes with. And let me see the... Okay, before I start all this, I want to say that motivation for the problem is, or motivation for considering these things is that when you have several mass scales in the problem, when you have different stages of symmetry breaking, the usual idea is to somehow decouple the two scales and then hope that supersymmetry or something or the other is taking care and keeping the mass scales uncoupled. What we want to show is that if topological objects are permitted, then because of the fact that for reasons of continuity of the field values and so on, the vacuum expectation value of the scalar condensate changes inside the topological defect as against outside. So even if you fine-tuned everything and set everything right outside, because of the fact that in the interior, the values go away from their usual values, there can be a mixing up of mass scales. And if this happens, then the core of the topological defect can cause tunneling. It can cause mixing with the other vacuum, and you can end up in the wrong vacuum. So I'm sorry, somehow the summary I had, we will see the summary in the end. So I'm going to present this talk in three parts. One was to, so we have quite a lot of numerical evidence. Oh, here. We have a lot of numerical evidence for this kind of destabilization of vacuum from topological defect in the case of both vortices and monopoles. And then recently we derived a formula which can be compared to Coleman's formula for homogeneous nucleation, but for seeded nucleation. So roughly the talk is in three parts. One is so this is one empirical example, so to speak. This is numerical. Right, catalyzed decay. So that is the, no, I don't have specific things to say for ISS, although that is the goal. But we are not able to match up the models we have with what ISS are saying. But, yeah. So we are headed there. But I think the formula we now have should be a good handle. So then, what's the word, a closed form formula. Compare, I would have said Coleman, but to be fair, it is Voloshin, Kobzarev, Okun, and then Coleman. And then more numerical examples in the case using monopoles. So this closed form formula is for what we call false monopoles. So monopoles in SU2, but with a triplet. Okay. I guess that's okay. I think I can do the rest of the talk using just the slides, so you don't have to. So just some of the English written up to what I was trying to say. It is not sufficient to study the translationally invariant or specially homogeneous avatars of the vacua, but topological defects such as cosmic strings or monopoles, although model dependent, in a class of them, we can show that a local minimum can be rendered unstable. So what a reflective potential shows as a local minimum may not actually be so globally. And in the case of cosmic strings or even monopoles, you can actually roll over smoothly to the true vacuum. And without any recourse to quantum tunneling. And in this way, a putative first order phase transition can become second order. So here is a simple cartoon picture of the simplest vortex line. We have U1 unbroken in the core of the defect. So that big pipe in the center is the defect, and U1 is broken outside. And you would have magnetic flux of the unbroken U1 in the core. But it is possible to have, when you have several complex, several scalar fields present, you can have so-called exotic configuration in which you can, so in a simple model, you could have a U1A and a U1B, which breaks, of course, I should have guessed. U1A cross U1B, which breaks to a diagonal U1, then U1A plus B would be broken in the core, but it will happen that the coupling between the scalars that signal U A plus B break down will eventually couple to the scalar field causing the vortex unsets. And in the core, we will have A minus B magnetic flux, because U1A minus B is broken outside. We will set up an ansatz using U1A minus B, so we will have a flux like in the Nielsen-Oleson case. But because the scalar that signaled this breakdown has to become zero in the core, the dynamics of the two scalar fields tends to turn up the wave of A plus B scalar in the core, and then you can have superconductivity in the core. This was Witten's paper, and I was trying to get hold of that simple example. He had this particular U1A cross U1B, but I think the picture is good enough. There is no need to really write the formulae. Right?
But he's designed the potential so that the energetics makes one turn on.
That's right. And actually, we were very close to designing it ourselves, but we're late. Okay, so here, that is what, in group theory, with larger, so not the simplest U1 cross U1 example. Yeah, so not the U1 cross U1, but if you had a larger gauge group like SO10, then it can happen that V effective has minima at phi 1, phi 2, etc. And the vortex ansatz is generated by some generators K, which means that there will be flux of the K field in the core of the vortex. But generically, the vacuum expectation values phi I may not always, not all of them would be neutral under the K that you can use to generate the vortex ansatz. And some pieces would be neutral under K and some not neutral. And so the actual phi in the presence of vortex, this is the Nielsen-Olsen form, which would have an overall modulus and then would wind around the vortex and then go to zero in the core. But because of the piece that remains neutral under the U1 used for winding the vortex ansatz, one also ends up with a scalar singlet part, which doesn't have to vanish in the core of the vortex because it doesn't have any theta dependent part. So this can be arranged, of course, by cleverly choosing the K such that it is not composed only of the broken generators, but some unbroken generators. And so theta dependence causes B at origin to be zero, but theta independence of the singlet part allows it to have a wave. And then you can have current corresponding to the charge of the phi S become supercurrent in the core of the vortex. So now I want to present this old numerical example of cosmic string induced or cosmic string catalyzed numerical instability. What we do is we have two possible local minima, S equal to 0 and S equal to S1. And in the presence of vortex at infinity, suppose this scalar field has zero wave. Or it could have vacuum expectation value S1. And generically, the vortex would render the S equal to 0 unstable. We would have a parameter in hand in the effective potential such that if the parameter becomes large, then it becomes unstable. So just to draw a picture, we have some field which is zero away from the vortex, and we are hoping that it would remain zero. But because of the dynamics of coupling to the vortex, it might become non-zero in the core of the vortex. But so suppose this is one possible minimum for it, S1, and this is S0. And so this is phi as a function of R. But if we have a potential for this, which is S0 and S1, such that the S1 is actually slightly lower. Then up to some amount of values of epsilon, the S0 vacuum can still be obtained. But once epsilon becomes larger than some amount, this cannot be sustained anymore, and we will have a catalyzed destabilization of the S0 vacuum. That's right, that's right. So if you just looked at the effective potential, the translation invariant effective potential, it would not be the favored vacuum. Also, I have in mind the idea of the early universe where there would be temperature. So the epsilon is actually controlled by temperature. At high temperatures, in fact, epsilon may be such that this lobe is higher. And as temperature drops, this becomes more favorable, but the system continues to be here, so it has to only tunnel through vacuum through quantum tunneling. But if you have defects present, then it helps to catalyze it and go to S1 more easily. Yeah.
Just with that picture, you don't know that there's any reason that the S1 vacuum would be kept in a local area. Then you need some topological defect. You need some monopole or vortex to hold it in.
Sorry? No, this. So this is V versus, I put the check, yeah.
Configuration, which is S1 at the origin and then
yes.
S0 outside.
Yeah.
And S0 is the unstable vacuum. Right?
That's true.
If it's just a bubble, it just expands.
No, it doesn't always.
Why not? Just a bubble.
Oh, so...
If you
have domain one... So if you have a domain wall, so you have just a one plus one dimensional example, then the moment this other vacuum becomes available, and if you make this large enough, then cotangent hyperbolic is a solution. You know, like it's a kink equation, but it allows both tan and cotangent. And the solution is unique in 1 plus 1. So you just have, it will immediately go to the true vacuum. But once you have cylindrical coordinates or spherical coordinates, it doesn't immediately go.
So I guess what's puzzling is that if you, in the normal homogeneous bubble nucleation story, you would have said that if you're trying to nucleate a true vacuum and you win a little bit of volume energy there, but then you're paying some gradient energy for the boundary.
Yes.
So for small enough bubbles, you don't win, so you have to get something big enough.
That's right. But once it's big enough, it goes. That's about right,
so yeah. So in this case, this is something which is a classically allowed solution, so it's like something which is big enough. So then, since you have positive, I guess it's a
it's a trade-off between the gradient energies here and Laplacian, the R squared factors or 1/r factors.
Yeah.
So it's not, we are not making any approximation of thin wall or anything like that. If you made a thin wall approximation, it's probably true that it will just, you can see that it will just go over to the true vacuum.
But this is something which is small enough that it's like a bubble, you've got
that's right.
Vacuum, and then there's a boundary.
Yeah.
This is small enough that it would have been inside the bubble.
Yes. Yeah.
You're saying that it's still a classically allowed configuration.
So it is. So if you then increase this epsilon, then it no longer remains confined, and then it tends to roll over.
Is that, so at that point where it starts to roll over, is that the point where the classical bubble is the same size as the thing you've
got? That I have not checked. The way we have checked is by doing a small oscillation analysis. So then this the core of the vortex acts like a background potential in which the small, so you try to set up a configuration like this and then study the fluctuations around this, then you find that when epsilon becomes large enough, the fluctuations develop a imaginary frequency.
Is the topology the thing helping make it stable, that you wound this thing up and so it can't decay to the homogeneous thing?
Initially the topology is trivial because asymptotically it is all vacuum. I mean, it's all homogeneous. It's only in the core that it is non-zero. But the topology changes at the end of the transition because it becomes non-zero everywhere.
But once you make your solution, is it true that there's a field at spatial density?
But there are two different scalar fields.
Is there one which is winding it?
Yes, one is certainly winding. Why is that a issue?
I'm just wondering what stops this thing. Why does this thing? Why does it not? What supports it? Why is it?
Well,
normally I would think of a powerful thing. It's the lowest energy configuration consistent with some topological boundary condition that you can't continuously get rid of, so you're kind of stuck with it. And it sounds like you're saying this is not one of those. It's not topologically stable. It's something which...
Wait a minute. This particular example, the vortex is going to remain stable. The vortex never destabilizes. Uh-huh. The presence of vortex destabilizes some other field's vacuum.
Well, when you draw this picture of everything getting bigger, it's not just the vortex.
No, the vortex remains where it is. The magnetic fluxes remain where they are. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So
that's with the two scalar fields. But with the monopole, you can't get rid of the
vortex. With monopole, the monopole example we have, what we have done is used only one scalar field, but used a sixth order potential. So that simplifies the field theory, but then there is a monopole with radially going out magnetic fields, and then it tunnels to a much larger monopole, after which it just keeps, the walls keep pushing out, so the fluxes get pushed out to infinity, and the monopole effectively goes away. So to begin with, it was a metastable monopole. And in the end, it just disappears. But in this, the first example that I'm giving with the vortices, the fluxes remain where they are. They just tumble over another scalar field.
If I sit infinity and I look at the magnetic field, is it 1 over r squared, and there's some integer over r squared, and that's not changing?
Well, eventually it will, because you'll not be actually at infinity. It will hit you. The wall, bubble wall will hit you.
Well, then I'm not infinity. So if I go outside the light cone at infinity, then the wall never gets
you. Yeah, then the wall never gets you.
Then it's true that you're never changing that chart.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah, so in a sense, if you remain outside of the causal bubble of the causal light cone of the expanding wall, then yeah, you can avoid seeing the wall. Yeah, you're living in the past.
I'm living simultaneously.
So let me see if I have. Yeah. So this is as Cliff had said, told you in the introduction, a very old picture. There are values of epsilon when you have two possible. So as you make epsilon value, say 0.01, and so between 0.07 and 0.1 is everything happens, you can obtain solutions up to some negative values of epsilon. But beyond that, numerically you find that it's difficult to converge to a solution. So the numerical evidence, the plot of expectation value of phi versus r. But here my two scales are very different. One is much larger than the other. So in the core, it is becoming very large. But it actually, the effect can be got even if you started with any value of the order 1 in the core. So the vortex itself is completely suppressed. The magnetic flux and the scalar forming the vortex are not shown in the picture, but only the field that responds to the presence of the vortex. Sure.
The three curves differ by what?
Okay, so the epsilon is changed from 0.07 to 0.1, but there are two curves with epsilon equal to minus 0.1. One is with the non-trivial vacuum, and one is with trivial vacuum asymptotically. And if you try to do that, your numerical processes don't converge. The Newton iteration method keeps stays somewhere around here, but doesn't really converge. So you take that as the evidence that that solution doesn't work, that trial doesn't work.
Was only one of those two curves is
resistant. Exactly. So only one of the two. And then if you give the asymptotically this condition, then it works. But I should tell you that at 0.07, minus 0.07, if you directly gave this as asymptotic trial solution, it works. You can certainly stay here if you like to begin with. But there is a small range of epsilon values where, because it is not a domain wall, nor do we have thin wall, it is possible to persist in the false vacuum. You're not convinced. But so one can do a stability analysis for small oscillations around this background, and you find that parametrically with epsilon, it actually develops a bound state in quantum mechanics problem.
So the idea is that if I turn up the coupling of the S field or the phi field fusion of the vortex,
yes,
then it wants to. So you could have, if this coupling is small enough, you could have a region around the vortex where you just have
right
preferred vacuum.
Yes.
Vacuum.
Yes.
And
yes.
Outside of that
is the metastable vacuum.
But once I turn up the coupling large enough.
Yes. Yeah. It just expands. So it is a parametric effect. It's not completely topological.
And does the coupling to the vortex determine all this value epsilon?
Yeah.
But there's enough.
No, I'm sorry. Coupling to the vortex is not really dependent on epsilon. Epsilon is a self-coupling, the quartic self-coupling essentially.
Okay.
Or an externally tuned effective mass squared like temperature contribution. So this is actually real-time evolution. If you substituted one of those unstable solutions as initial condition and just let it go with zero velocity, you get kink-like solutions expanding into the vacuum outside. Okay. So then, armed with this very old example, we first actually wondered about whether some of the GMSB, the gauge-mediated supersymmetry breaking examples, which use a gauge group in the mediation sector, whether effectively this gets... So the problem here is that often you have a choice between color-breaking vacua and color-preserving vacua. And you have to fine-tune things so that you remain in the color-preserving but supersymmetry-breaking vacuum. So here we showed that this kind of phenomenon can destabilize you from color-preserving vacuum and force you into a supersymmetry-preserving color-breaking vacuum. And so we have these two fields, P and N, which are scalars. There are also Q and Q bar, messenger quarks, which actually have SU3 charges, color charges, and you want the squark expectation values to remain zero. And there is a coupling between the two because of this superpotential. So let's see. So the effective potential in the messenger sector has P squared minus N squared. Those are the two scalars. This is the singlet field which actually couples to the standard model, P squared plus N squared. And there is a coupling S squared with QQ bar. And there is a term of this form with QQ bar and PN mod squared. So there is a coupling between the squark fields and the P and N fields. And because P and N have a U1 charge, you can actually set up a vortex ansatz for them. There's some conditions on stability. Yeah, so the two vacua that are possible, the one in which the scalars have a well, but the squarks don't have well, is like this. So P and N have a well, and the S field has a well. And then there are two possibilities. One in which Q bar vacuum expectation values remain zero, but ones in which they actually become non-zero. And we can show that you can arrange it so that V2, the squark fields having non-zero vacuum expectation value, actually has lower vacuum expectation value than the preferred vacuum. And so people argue that, well, if you make this vacuum sufficiently metastable, you are not going to see the decay into true vacuum till the end of the universe, whenever that is. But if the cosmic strings are supported, then we denote this vacuum as V1 with spring and V2 with spring. And just remember that V1 is the preferred one. V1 is the preferred one, but it is metastable. So we worked out all this detail, and then we simulated the solutions. So here is the P and N field vacuum expectation values, and here are the Squark field expectation values. And as you tune the parameters, you find that it is impossible to have the Q vacuum expectation value remain zero. The Squarks also acquire non-zero vacuum expectation values. And this is cross and dot analysis to just show that, there were several parameters in the problem, lambda 1, lambda 2, and kappa. So we just wanted to see the phase boundaries. We didn't make a big phase plot, but we know the point at which V1 will no longer be available, and V2, the disfavored vacuum, is the one that becomes only one possible. And it will roll over from V1 to V2. Whereas if you didn't have, so it is all V1 with spring, V2 with spring. So if you did not have spring present, then of course you could claim that you were living in a metastable vacuum forever. But that is no longer allowed in this case. Sorry?
Maybe the previous one with the K time was long enough that it was longer than the age of the universe. How do we know this is not shorter but still longer than the age of the universe?
So the thing is that parametrically, so you could still tune your parameters so that you remain in the metastable vacuum. It is still possible to get away with the metastability argument, but your space of parameters gets reduced. But once the parameters become going to a certain range, it will be something like this. It will just promptly roll over into the false vacuum.
Do you have a sense as to how much of restriction of parameter space it is?
No. Not yet. Yeah, I mean, we are still trying to gather the basic evidence. I guess we haven't done a more comprehensive job of the implications for realistic theories. So the way we check that this is actually true is by studying the effective potential that the Squark fields would see in the background of the vortex. And you can, again, because the couplings are cubic and quartic, we don't have a, it's, yeah, so what we have done is taken the background field for the P and N fields, plug them back into the effective potential, and calculate the radial dependence of the potential that the Squark small oscillations would see as the background field. And you find that exactly, so the lambdas were some parameters there, and exactly at the boundary where the instability sets in, you find that this potential becomes sufficiently negative to allow a bound state for the small oscillation problem, for the effective Schrodinger equation problem. And so where it becomes, where it develops a sufficiently negative dip is where we claim that favored vacuum actually becomes unstable. So, but what is the how much of this parameter space we have lost? I don't have an estimate yet.
So, if I have some mechanism by which I got to this to the vacuum that we want, then I for whatever reason I got rid of all of the strings.
Okay.
Is it okay then, or can you?
Yeah, if you made sure there were no strings around, then you are fine.
Well, so is that a problem usually, or?
Well, because the thing is,
exactly.
You're hierarchy. So the big horizon, you'll have a string and something hard not to have strings.
Yeah. That's my answer. Yeah, that's the answer. Yeah. So, but he just asked a mathematical question. If there are no cosmic strings present in the medium, then yes, you can live with the metastable vacuum. But we believe that usually these things arise sequential, dynamically in the early universe, and so. Oh, yeah. So we can live with cosmic strings. They are not so bad. Yeah.
What is not so bad
mean? Sorry? What is not so bad means that they would not have left any signature that affects any of the cosmological data till date. If you have sufficiently low energy cosmic strings, if you have gut scale cosmic strings, then they would have interfered with some of the data today. But even those, because cosmic strings have mutual annihilations. So again, there are classes of cosmic strings. There are classes of cosmic strings which, as they say, scale. The string network scales with the expansion of the universe. So the amount of energy stored in the loops remains a certain fraction of the total energy. In this case, you will never actually detect them, because they keep crossing themselves and the loops keep shrinking and dumping energy into the surrounding medium, then very difficult to see them. But so anything that is lower than about 10 to the 15 GeV, the limit is G mu has to be, so G gravitational constant times, I think G mu greater than 10 to the minus 6. And mu is, so I guess, mu squared. This is the string tension, mass per unit length in the string times G. If it is greater than 10 to the minus 6, it is. It actually would have affected galaxy formation. Okay. But less than that, it is not going to affect. Now, if you have cosmic strings that are not going away by commuting and crossing, then of course there is a problem. They would begin to fill the universe, and eventually they will soak up all the energy of the universe and it could cause a small positive exponent growth of the scale factor. But that positive growth would be too small to explain the dark energy problem also. It would be somewhere in between. And the effects it would leave on WMAP would be bad too. A network of this kind left over, which is not going away. But the usual lore is that they are capable of mutually, kneel to rock, and it was to rock and who, the first people to simulate this crossing of strings, and Albrecht, I think, Albrecht and Turok. Yeah. So I think their evidence was that approximately some large fraction of them keep crossing each other, and some cosmic strings remain very long. But the length of them per unit volume kind of stabilizes beyond a certain point. So they don't conflict with cosmology. But very heavy strings would. MSSM doesn't have cosmic strings. Yeah, I don't know about N MSSM, but MSSM, no, even N MSSM, it's a singlet, so it doesn't matter.
No, so why is that?
The topology is, there are doublets of SU2, so they don't have a residual discrete group left. Discrete, finite subgroup like a ZN or a Z2.
So if I embedded the MSSM into something like a supermetric gate,
Then you can.
So you need SU2 with
triplets.
You need SU2 with
triplets? Yes, yes. If you had triplets, then you could have cosmic strings.
So how about, can you comment on just supersymmetry ranking models in general? I suppose it's model dependent.
It is model dependent simply on the statement of what is the residual group, whether the residual group contains discrete pieces or not. So G go to H cross a Z2. So if you can identify a Z2, then there will be cosmic strings. But if there is no such discrete group left and only simply connected subgroups left, then...
So you could imagine it's supersymmetry breaking models don't have, also don't support the topological.
Yes. Don't support is, of course, easy.
Okay.
But to support, you have to search. So long as you have low dimension, so long as you have fundamental spinner representations, it will not. But you can... And also it has to do more with the scalar fields. So fermions, like SO10 contains strings. And SO10, the fermions are in 16 plet. But the breaking is usually done using 126 or 45 or one of the big representations. Then you have cosmic strings. And those could have been stable and would have affected galaxy formation. But we know now that the effect they have on galaxy formation is not to produce scale invariant spectrum. So it is not a favored mechanism for galaxy formation also.
You're thinking this is a way to avoid the problems that...
I'm just wondering how generic the problem is.
Yeah.
Like if you have cosmic strings.
So yeah, this is the condition.
Your salt on ISS doesn't turn out. You might want to look at little Higgs models. That class of models generically has... They're not in good shape at the moment, but they generically have SU.
That's right, yeah. They want to have the pseudo
model. They also have, you know, other vacuum solutions, which are not great in this type of model nature.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Want to look at that.
That's right.
So is it coming from a real scalar, like a real representation? Or it's not necessarily?
It's mainly tensor, not the fundamental. That's the trick, usually. To have leftover discrete subgroups. Because if you have fundamentals, then they detect a 2-pi rotation immediately. You know, they differ by a phase. But if you have a higher tensor, then it has gone through 2 or 3 windings and can't detect minus signs because it's like a similarity transformation. So minus signs disappear. So higher dimensional representations would allow this to persist. But if you have a doublet Higgs, then it is not going to allow a cosmic string.
Is that true even in the standard model that you had, if I had some?
Yeah. If you had a Georgi Glashow model, then of course you would have had cosmic strings too. Okay. So now we come to metastable monopoles. And how much time do I have? Yeah, but remember that the stick is with me.
But we're all used to it, though. You never played before.
Vlog. So this is the model we constructed here at in Montreal. We consider an SU2 gauge theory, but with a triplet scalar. And there are the usual gauge field terms, and then this covariant derivative is for a scalar, a triplet scalar. And then in lieu of or a placeholder for a background field, we actually put a sixth order potential. So it is phi squared times phi squared minus a squared whole squared. So if you don't look at the rest of the stuff, this says that there is a... sixth order potential, which is, or maybe it is plotted next, so let's not spend time. Yeah. So we have a potential that looks like this, and if the other stuff was not there, it would be just be symmetric like this with a double root at origin and then at plus eta and minus eta, just to the parameters. Yeah, the A, sorry, has been written as eta there. But then we add a little bit of phi squared term, positive phi squared. But then so once we add that phi squared, we increase the curvature at the origin. but that would push the whole potential up. So just for convenience, we added an epsilon to arrange such that these minima are at zero value of potential and the central dip goes negative. Now we can set up a magnetic monopole so that it winds in this space. So this, what we have shown as only eta and minus eta, is actually a sphere in the internal space. It's a subspace of SU2. It's a two sphere. And the scalar triplet can wind around that and form a monopole. However, at the core, the ansatz function has to go to zero. So at the core, it is going to sample this true vacuum which is available to it. And that is the whole upshot of the story. So here is phi written out as pointing in various directions, r cap with a h, which would be approximately constant far away from the monopole, but has to go to zero at the origin. This is standard form for the AMU gauge field. Different members of the gauge group masquerade as U1 field in different directions. A0 is zero. Yeah. Yes. Not. Well, no, then we would not have put negative coefficient for phi to the 4. Our formula that we derive is dependent on this. But what we believe is that this is a generic case and that such a formula can be derived. And using it, we are able to see actually a better, better control than these numerical examples where they were trying to run me down, you know. So, but here we can actually see regimes in which you will have a metastable monopole and then regimes in which it actually just a rollover like the one I have. We have a formula which shows tunneling in certain regimes and then a rollover beyond a certain regime of parameter. But again, we have not estimated the size of the parameter. Yeah, even string cosmology and the KKLT, they all live by unstable. Trivedi is my good friend, but it doesn't stop me from. We want three roots, and see, if you know, Coleman draws stuff where this would be a stable one and another unstable one, but you cannot think of any symmetric potentials that do this, you know. So you need to, if you have a root at minus eta, you have
symmetric is because he wants that
too. You want a monopole too, and you are trying to construct it out of.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't want to put cubic terms in the phi cube kind of terms because it's representing some gauge group. So they are typically all.
Two scalars. Can you somehow?
Yes, that is the next project. Okay. So we could try to simulate it. But the point is whether then you will have the analytic control is not clear. Here we have things with a lot of control. And incidentally, the Planck-suppressed terms have all been considered. So I have next a quote realistic supersymmetric example. Some friends were working out SU5. And automatically they needed to put Planck suppressed sixth order terms to get the vacuum right. So it is not all that unrealistic. Even sixth order terms appear in supersymmetric grand unification. So this is the energy and, So to the way we are able to actually get a formula is by assuming that we have tuned parameters. This is something that is unintelligible unless you actually look at the details. But you can find a domain of parameters where you can arrange thin wall solutions in the sense that the monopole is such that the ansatz functions remain more or less zero up to a value r and then suddenly change to their asymptotic values. So the picture is here. something like this. For r closer to zero, it is the scalar field is zero, and this is the gauge field, but it's the gauge potential, so it just remains constant. But you can turn on the at some point, the monopole suddenly appears. Well, the monopole solution is such that there is a large part where it is in the false vacuum, and then over a small region of space, it turns into the true vacuum. This is required because if you plug in, if you plug in this kind of ansatz, this is the energy function, which looks all very ugly. But the point is, once you have this thin wall, you can replace things by, like, these R squares by just the value of this capital R and extract an energy function E in terms of the effective coordinate capital R. Oh, Steinhardt. Steinhardt. But he didn't work out the solution. Yeah. He was fumbling in the dark. Sorry, I didn't say that. So you get an effective potential for the collective coordinate R, which looks like this. Actually, it has another minimum somewhere back there. But roughly what we are now trying to show is that you have a monopole of size R1, but there is a size R2 available also for the same solution, except that it has the tendency to just roll over to the true vacuum. So our problem is slightly compounded compared to Coleman and Voloshin, Kobzarev, Okun problem, because they did, after all, take potential that was turning over. So if they flip the potential over, they still have an approximate local extremum, but we do not have a local extremum there. Oops. Yeah. Yes. So the Euclidean action, which would become the bounds, is of this form in terms of R. And so the instanton has to be found subject to the usual story on the boundary conditions. R is in the false vacuum asymptotically in the true vacuum in the core, and it is zero at tau equal to zero at the origin. Now, what is nice is that although it looks so complicated, if you find the equation of motion for the collective coordinate, you can actually do a first integral, and you do have a conserved quantity, which allows you to simplify the bounds further. And in the end, we got this glorious expression. So there is still an R dot remaining, which we have to eliminate using the other integral of motion. And we end up with a fifth order polynomial in R with square root. But it is possible to factor this by making estimates of what the various R1, R2 have to be. And again, by using the thin wall approximation and the parameters, it is possible to estimate what these have to be in terms of the parameters of the potential. R2 is the large one, which is where it is going to emerge eventually. And it has 1 over epsilon in it, which is our control for where we set the zero of the potential. So eventually, we have a bounds answer, which is proportional to R minus R. So it is possible to scale out R and R1 out of the problem. We are left with a elliptic integral of some kind, which doesn't have to be evaluated. But a proportionality in front, which aside from R2, the large radius that we got, which is proportional to 1 over epsilon, we do get a factor in front, which is of the form R2 minus R1. What this means is that there is a regime in which, So there is a regime in which R1 could be close to R2, and in which case this bounds goes to zero or can become very small. So this is our rollover case. It doesn't hang out there at all. But if R1 and R2 are greatly different, as in the previous figure, So this is R1 and this is R2. So the solution is proportional to this difference. And if it happened that this bump was not very big, then it would just roll over to the true vacuum because the bound section would go to zero and it appears in the exponent. Okay, so here is that promised example of So I can show where that I dropped it off somewhere. God, where was it? I kept it here. So there is a, this is the electromagnetic contribution actually, S2. But S2 comes added with S1, which is from the scalar part, but S1 part comes out multiplied by R squared. So the contribution from electromagnetic field, which is proportional to 1 over E, goes away from the problem. From the final answer. Yes. So this is our famous final answer, or to be famous. Note the 16 divided by 105, very important factors. Yeah. Oh, this exponent, of course. Oh, you are going into unnecessary. Yeah. So we do have a realistic example considered by realistic authors. Where they have an SU5 with two adjoint sigma 1s and sigma 2s. And in order to get realistic final phenomenological potential, they had to choose the super potential with some higher order terms in the, that's only sigma cubed. So at least this is, there is a sigma 2 outside, right? Trace of sigma 2 times, and then there are these two cubic terms. So it's an effective quartic term in the super potential. And we could actually set up the SU5 monopole for this SU5 theory, and we had exactly what we have later taken, metastable minimum at large values of R and a true minimum at lower values, except that in this case we were not playing any devil because this is the preferred state. So even if you were stuck with... So, in fact, our answer in this case would be if you got accidentally stuck here, well, you could get exited to that using monopoles. So it's the same kind of story, V1 in presence of monopole, V2 in presence of monopoles, and various numerical things. And this is zero expectation value far away. Okay, so here we have... plotted a parameter space, which is disallowed without monopoles is here, all of this. But disallowed with monopole is some regime like this. But here, this is actually ratio of the mass in the problem to the suppressing mass of the sixth order term. And this is one of the vacuum expectation values. So here it is actually large. So if you thought that you had this much space then actually it gets curtailed to this much. If you lived from everywhere from here, everywhere below, you would earlier be living everywhere below this. But with monopoles present, it actually gets, all this goes away and you can live only there. So this is the summary. Several bosonic components. That would be the more realistic thing to do, but existence of these would be parametric, that we agree. But you can have real-time rollover as opposed to tunneling. And messenger sectors, direct Suzy braking, actually doesn't cause a problem, but it does bring you to the desired vacuum more easily. And we do have now a closed form formula for false monopoles interpolating between seeding, seeded tunneling, and rollover. Yeah.
So, just to follow up on what Mani was saying, you had this you're bound in a way when R1 is R2, but I lost track of what, in the original potential with the sextic potential, what were the parameters that were constrained?
Yeah. Okay.
So here, what's the thing that you're dialing to make R1 equal R2? You have lambda, gamma, A, and epsilon.
So A is the mass. Yeah. Right here, yes. No charge, which is because I didn't write out the, yeah, so E is in the.
Do you have a formula for R1 minus R2 or R2 minus R1? Is it, because I thought you had a slide somewhere which was.
Yeah.
This formula is at the end, right? It has all the terms, the volume term.
I'm not doing it for me. I gotta see R1 minus R2 and something.
I have estimates for R1 and R2 in terms of the parameters. Maybe next. Yeah. Now, what is sigma? So R3 is same as minus twice R1, which is not very far away. But R2 is large and proportional to sigma over.
So what's sigma?
Sigma. What's sigma? Yeah, the contribution to the area term. So it would come from here in the R4 term, and that will come from. I had the things written, but I removed because. Yeah. So it would come from the surface term, and therefore it would have. Independent of E, but it would depend on just the mass scale in the problem.
So
and
that, where R1 is equal to something. So R1 has a 1 over E to the 1, 2/3.
Uh-huh.
R3 is a negative root that we don't care about. R2 is large and it's independent. So as E gets small, R1 gets bigger and bigger and starts to approach. And these roots are the roots of that polynomial. Polynomial effect.
That's what you're saying.
And the 1 over E term is the divergence of the origin. And as E gets large, the minimum is going up.
Right.
And you know, when there is no minimum, R1 is equal to R2. Okay. And the rest of the potential is sort of not strong.
Back as in back.
I want the expression for the energy of E of R, the three terms in.
Oh, yeah.
I guess so you're saying
this is future, right?
So yeah, no, I get that. I get that.
Yeah, so minus alpha is going to include E, the sigma r squared is the area,
mm-hmm.
and the C is 1 over E,
right,
squared.
So, but is the statement that, so you're saying that small e is the one that likes to. small, you know, charge e, but does that mean that it's a generic small e, or do I have to adjust small e to be canceling some other term to get the instability?
Yeah, there are no cancellations.
It's only tuning.
Well, eventually, when R1 is bigger than R2,
want this to come closer once it's.
So we couple it sucks, you say.
Glory to ADS CFT.
Only assumption required is that both R1 and R2 are dark. Right? That's the thing.
Okay.
All
right, well, thanks again.
Okay, thank you.